The Secrets of Middle-Earth is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Middle-Earth, where we discuss the hidden themes and deeper layers found in the works of J.R.R. Tolkien, whether in his writings or in any of the media derived from them. I'm Thomas Salerno, and joining me today on the panel are Jeff Hecker. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Thomas.
And Pat Mason. Hey there, Pat.
Howdy, Thomas.
And be sure to follow The Secrets of Middle-Earth. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. And don't forget the StarQuest YouTube channel. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/StarQuestMedia, on X, where we are at SQPN, or on Instagram, where we are at StarQuest Network. And be sure to get your official Secrets of Middle-Earth gear, including our awesome t-shirt, at sqpn.com/merch. So we are continuing our steady march through the Silmarillion this week with focusing on chapters 6 through 8 of the Quenta Silmarillion, dealing with the darkening of Valinor. So this is, as we kind of talked a little bit before we started recording, this is kind of the hinge section of the Quenta Silmarillion, right? Where, you know, these next three chapters here are going to set up pretty much everything that comes later.
Yep, it's sort of like you get movement here and that swings the door open to all of the terrible that comes after. Which is funny because Tolkien like writes that in several times in these chapters. Of all the things that happened later on, they always called him Feanor. Or
oh, because right, of all the,
yeah, it's just constantly hearkening to what's coming.
Yeah, these chapters are very ominous, right? You know, I feel like even if you've never read them before, you could get the idea that something bad is very bad is about to happen. The way these chapters are written, there's like a background of impending doom, I think, throughout. What did you guys think overall of these chapters before we dive in on the minutia in my very excessive notes? But what did you guys think of the darkening of Valinor, the introduction of Feanor, all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, these are interesting chapters, and yeah, you get the sense of who Feanor is, and he doesn't really change throughout the rest of the book you kind of set the tone right away that he's, and it's kind of interesting because I believe the first chapter is the of Feanor and Unchaining of Melkor, so it's kind of linking them intrinsically right away that they're, you know, there's some kind of connection there, or, you know, parallel between them. So going through the whole and the tragedy of the trees, which for those who haven't read this but have seen Rings of Power, we actually kind of see a little bit of a version of when the trees that die in Valinor at the beginning of I believe it's in the first episode, in like the prologue.
Yeah, the prologue. Yeah,
you don't see you know, a spider coming. Drink the trees dry or anything like that. That'd probably be pretty gross on screen, but you see, yeah, so it's going back to that, which is, you know, it's cool that we're kind of like getting to that in here. So yeah, no, but yeah, these are interesting, but definitely like sad and foreboding chapters, for sure.
What about you, Pat? Do you have any opening thoughts?
You know, this is one of the few times Mandos actually talks before the bad thing happens.
Yeah.
So I always have to note that because it's like it's very clear that this is supposed to be a super important set of events. And it's interesting because I would call this kind of the transition chapters between the what Tolkien tends to do with the Silmarillion, or I've seen, is that you get a chapter that explains the thing, whatever the thing is, and then a chapter that actually like goes about like what's happening in time. And so we have the chapter that sort of explains Feanor, and then we get the chapter that sort of explains what he was doing. And then you sort of build from that into the actual events of the Quenta Silmarillion, that kind of start with the darkening of Valinor is just like, this is a thing that is now happening. And we're no longer really explaining a lot of stuff because we finally explained who all the characters were. Not that you'll remember them all. I'm going to flip back several chapters. Who was this guy and why is he important again? But
Why do so many people's names start with F? It's so confusing. Yes. Finway, Fingolfin, Finarfin, Feanor. I'm like, what? Okay. Yes.
Why? And why does everybody have to have at least at a minimum two names?
Two names, yes.
It's like, oh, her name was Marieth, and they also called her a little Adelan for some other reason. I'm like, why? Why do they have to call her that? Why couldn't they just call her by her name?
I mean, you know, like, in reading Tolkien's letters, he mentions several times how he's like, he's in love with both the major elven languages that he created. So I'm pretty sure he's like, I've got to invent names for them in both languages. And I'm like, like, why? But you know,
but why?
No, it's great. We get all these great names. And even Feanor himself, we often forget that he has like that. That's kind of the name his mom gives them, which we can, I guess, just jump right in. Then the first chapter we're dealing with is of Feanor and the Unchaining of Melkor, as you mentioned, Jeff. And it says pretty much right off the bat that this is, we're at what's called the noontime of the Blessed Realm. So like the elves have already moved to Valinor, or the Eldar, rather, and they're living in bliss. Essentially, it's like this Eden state. And you have one of the I think Feanor's dad, right? He's one of the original. He was the original leader of the Noldor, right? He was one of the three leaders that went over originally. Right. So Finwë, and his wife gives birth to a son who is Cúru Finwë. But he's also Feanor. Yeah. Which means Feanor meaning spirit of fire, because his mother is a very interesting story. She kind of dies, quote unquote, even though elves aren't supposed to die naturally. Giving birth to her son kind of consumes all her life force or something like that. And she calls him the spirit of fire. And she essentially dies of weariness, and there's that first bringing of kind of sorrow to Valinor, through Feanor's very birth, brings sorrow to Valinor. That should have been a red flag.
Yeah. Cause you have that line where like Finwë is just, it's the only sorrow in Aman.
Right. Yeah. Like, out of everybody there, he's the only one who can't be happy. Because his wife, Miriel, which is a name we'll see later, right? Because that's also the name of one of the queens of Numenor. From, if you've seen The Rings of Power, right? There's a character called Miriel. So we'll see that name later. But this is an elf, Feanor's mother. Yeah, it says... I wrote down that she dies after giving birth from weariness. She goes to the gardens of Lorien, and her spirit passes to the halls of Mandos, but she refuses to reincarnate. So that's interesting. She just stays in the halls of Mandos, because normally an elf after a certain period of time would come back. But so that there's that initial bringing of kind of that first inkling that something is not exactly right. But Feanor himself becomes a student of Aule, the smith, and he's called the most subtle in mind of all the Noldor, who are kind of the most creative of the elves in terms of crafting stuff. And I just think it's interesting that of Tolkien's major villains, and if you want to call Feanor a villain, he's not, you know, like a dark lord or anything, but he is still a character who does a lot of evil stuff. There's this connection between evil characters like Sauron, Saruman, and Feanor, and that desire to craft things that are their own. You know, and they become obsessed with the works of their hands. What do you guys think of that theme?
Well, it goes back to the sub-creation idea that has been in there since the Ainulindale, where, you know, you get the contrast between Melkor and someone like Owl. Like, Melkor wants to go and create things of his own for himself, whereas Aule is wanting to, when he creates the dwarves, he's wanting to imitate what Eru Iluvatar did. And ultimately he makes the right choice in saying, you know, if it's your will, Eru Iluvatar, I will, you know, destroy my creations. But, you know, of course Eru takes pity on his, on the creations, and we get the dwarves. Whereas Melkor, who couldn't really create anything, he had to kind of twist things in order to, you know, make the orcs and, you know, other things. Like, he doesn't really make anything of his own. He tries to subcreate, but he's not really subcreating. He's kind of like trying to usurp the creator. And that's kind of what, you know, like what Sauron and the others of these, you know, villainous people do, is they create things for themselves versus creating things for, you know, for the good of the world, or the good of, you know, their people or whatever.
Yeah, I find that it's sort of an interesting, I would almost say, like, third path, because you have, like, creation, you know, we have the Smith God creating kind of under Iluvatar, you know, and in compliance with Iluvatar's will, but not, he creates not just for his own sake, but for the sake of anybody, and really he delights in the creation itself, not so much necessarily the created thing.
Right.
And you have Melkor, on the other hand, who is envious and jealous of the other creation and seeks to tear it down. And that's kind of his whole theme throughout so far. You know, once we get on Arda, he's taking the form of a mountain and destroying the works, or he's tearing down the towers with the lights. He's always in the process of destroying somebody else's creation, or the one that really ticks off Iluvatar, which is the creation of the orcs, mm-hmm. you know, from the elves. And then we have kind of Fëanor in the middle, who he's not seeking to downplay anybody else's works. He's not seeking to twist them or destroy them. He's seeking to do, like, the best possible thing, but he's doing it all for himself. And he's very jealous of that, of the things he makes, you know, almost to the point where I would rather destroy it than have somebody else have it. Like, even if it was a delight to them and it did nobody any harm, I would rather it be destroyed than have somebody else have it. And that's sort of like, it's not a good path, but it's different from Melkor. And that's how sort of his villainous strain. And that makes him sort of different from kind of the Melkor, Morgoth, Saruman, Sauron sort of strain of being.
Yeah, at least right here at this part, he's more of a bully and jerk than he is like an evil guy. Like,
yes. Yeah.
We can argue about if he becomes evil later.
Yeah. But he hasn't committed atrocities yet.
No.
But
nope.
He's starting down that path. And it seems to start very early with family issues, because his father, Finwë, remarries. He takes a new wife, Indis, who's of the Vanyar, who are kind of the elves who are closest to Manwë and Varda, and kind of they're devoted to them, and they have their, you know, they're most like in mind to Manwë and Varda. And it says, like, The shadow of his first wife did not depart from him. So he's still pining for his first wife. And he loves Fëanor more than the sons he has by his second wife. And those sons are Fingolfin and Finarfin. So out of his three sons, he has a preference for Fëanor. Which is interesting, because if You could see him very reasonably wanting to shun Fëanor, like, or blame him for Muriel's death, but he does not. Instead, he kind of holds on to Fëanor as, like, the last, you know, as kind of a piece of Muriel that he can hold on to.
Yeah, and I think, I could be wrong, but I think in Elvish, you know, in Tolkien's Elvish culture, the elves don't typically remarry if one of their spouses dies, I don't think, because there's the idea that you're going to be reunited in, you know, either in the halls of Mandos or, you know, somewhere down the road, you'll be, you know, reincarnated together. So, but his first wife obviously didn't. So it's a very odd situation that he chose to remarry, because, you know, for one, his wife isn't coming back in any way. And then for two, instead of, you know, living as a widower, he chooses to remarry and, you know, cause more problems but also good things result from his other children. So,
yeah, the book says this explicitly. There's an interesting quote where Tolkien kind of engages in like what if scenarios. It says, quote, "In those unhappy things which later came to pass, and in which Feanor was the leader, many saw the effect of this breach within the House of Finwë, judging that if Finwë had endured his loss and been content with the fathering of his mighty son, the courses of Feanor would have been otherwise, and great evil might have been prevented." But like you say, Jeff, they also then say, but then the great deeds of Fingolfin and Finarfin would not have come to pass either. So there's this interesting kind of tension in this what if scenario.
Yeah, I like how it ends. It's like, and the Eldar would have been lesser for it.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And you're just like, well, that's a pretty strong statement.
Right. Really, the bringing of a greater good out of evil, which goes all the way back to the Ainu Lindale, when Eru Iluvatar tells Melkor, "You cannot alter the music in my despite. I'll simply take the discord and bring a greater theme out of it in the end." So you can see how the Ainu Lindale, like, I guess some people skip it, but it is super important because the ripples of it are throughout the entire Silmarillion.
Yeah, because we find out that Galadriel is of the Noldor, so she's one of the greatest elves in all of history, and she came from I forget which exactly her lineage is, but she's from one of, I believe she's one of the other sons.
Finarfin.
Okay, yeah, Finarfin. Yeah. So, and then his brother Finrod is her brother, and he also does a lot of great things. So, yeah, it's unfortunate what happens to his, you know, Feanor's mom, but it's also, we get the good out of with those other, you know, what becomes later. So to kind of make up for some of the Feanor stuff.
Oh, and like with Galadriel, that was actually one of my favorite like geek out moments of Rings of Power, is when she's in the Numenorean courtroom and she says her lineage. "I'm Galadriel the Noldor, daughter of the Golden House of Finarfin." And I'm like, yeah, like, you know, it was like that was just a geek out moment for me.
Yeah, and we'll get to it later, but she has an interesting relationship with Feanor too.
That's right. Yeah.
I think it's in the next chapter after this that it comes up.
But yeah, so we see this like slow, like there are these warning signs that things are not quite right. And we get to the point where it's been, I think they say, three entire ages. And I know that time is counted differently before the sun and moon appear. Like in Valian years, the years of the trees, time is like, I don't know if he's ever really specific on what a Valian year is. But yeah, in any case, Melkor's been in the halls of Mandos for a long time. But his parole hearing is upon us, because the term of his punishment is over. He's brought before the Valar again. And it was interesting. I think they even mentioned like when he sees the elves in their bliss with the Valar, and he just becomes so jealous and full of hate, but he hides it. He hides it, and he abases himself, sues for pardon at the feet of Manwë, and promises to aid the Valar in healing all the hurts that he's caused. And it's interesting, Nienna, the Vala of Pity, is kind of his advocate that he should be released. And that's an interesting thing, because I believe later it mentions she is one of the teachers of Gandalf, Nienna the Weeper. Because she, her,
I can't remember. Yeah.
Because her province is pity.
Right.
And I believe that it's like Gandalf, he learned pity from her. And, you know, his mission is to oppose the Dark Lords. And it's kind of, you know, because of Nienna's prayers that a lot of this comes to pass.
Mandos doesn't talk. He stays silent for this one.
Again. Yeah.
And I'm like, you were his jailer for three ages, whatever that means, and you're not even going to say anything? I mean, come on, man.
No, yeah, he says nothing. And it says, like, he's able to convince people, and he's given freedom to, like, go around to what he's essentially, you know, let out, like, and is allowed to walk around Amon to the point where Manwë believes he's cured.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love that. Manwë is too naive.
Basically. That's basically what it says. Yeah, there's a quote here. Quote, for Manwë was free from evil and could not comprehend it. And he knew that in the beginning, in the thought of Ilúvatar, Melkor had been even as he. And he saw not the depths of Melkor's heart and did not perceive that all love had departed from him forever.
Which I always find that funny because Tolkis is walking around like wanting to punch him in the face the whole time. Every time he sees him, he's like,
yeah, he's like,
gets his hands, and he's like, Tolkis is not, like, you know, the smart one here, but he can see through Melkor. He knows so, what's going
and
on.
And so does Ulmo. Ulmo is also not deceived. And there's, but it, there's an interesting aside to that, in that both of them obey Manwe's judgment. It's like you said, Tolkas is like, you know, cracking his knuckles whenever he sees Melkor walk by, but yeah. He never does anything because he know. And it says, Tolkien writes, those who would defend authority from rebellion must not themselves become rebels. So they know that if they were to go after Melkor, they would kind of be coming like him, you know, because they're thinking, oh, well, I know better. I know better than Manwë or Ilúvatar. So they have, but they actually don't. They actually stay loyal, even though they know, like, this is not going to end well. We can't trust this guy.
I always feel like Ulmo is probably dealing with some of the problems that Melkor caused prior to his capturing, right? Because Ulmo's still, like, in and amongst the waterways in Middle Earth at this point. And so he's probably still encountering orcs and the other nasty creatures. And he's probably just like constantly reminded, oh, I hate this guy. Like, all of these problems.
Yeah, because he's the one who kind of wanders the world. You know, he doesn't stay in Amon. He kind of goes, like you say, he goes out into the waterways and he gets to see, like, a lot. He also probably remembers, hey, you tried to convert my vassal Ausse to evil, you know. I feel like Ulmo is a guy who doesn't forget things like that too easily. But Melkor knows exactly what he's doing. He doesn't, he basically ignores the Vanyar. He knows that those, because he wants to corrupt and destroy the elves, but he knows the Vanyar are kind of too loyal to Manwë and Varda to even bother with. The Teleri, he basically thinks they're beneath his notice for some reason. But he just focuses on the Noldor, probably because since the Noldor are those interested in lore and crafting and are interested in subcreation, I guess he hates them because he sees too much of himself, maybe, in them. And because he was such a rival with Aule. But yeah, but it says Feanor. It's interesting because you'd think, like, you know, he'd immediately try and go to corrupt the most powerful of them, which is Feanor. But it says Feanor hated Melkor. He wouldn't even speak to him. And he just works by himself. That's another thing. I think, Jeff, you mentioned this before, that, like, Feanor just creates for himself, right? Like, so it even says, like, he works alone. He doesn't work with anybody. Like, yeah, he had teachers like Aule and some of the other elven smiths, but as soon as he learns what he needs to from people, he just discards them and he works by himself.
Yeah, he's the kid on the group project that just wants to go and do it all themselves and take, you know, or be, you know, have no partners in his project.
So. Take all the credit.
Well, I don't know. I think it's just he would just be asking the professor, like, I just want to be on my own. You know, I want to be on my own. I don't want any partners or teammates or anything because I can do it all on my own better than anyone else. So.
So, yeah, that moves us into the next chapter of the Silmarils and the unrest of the Noldor. So name drop the Silmarils, what the whole Silmarillion is named after. We finally get, what are we, seven chapters in? Well, seven chapters in of the Quintus Silmarillion plus the matter before that. We finally have the creation of Silmarils.
Cue the Leo DiCaprio pointing meme.
That's right. what is that even? I'm so ignorant. What is that even from? Do you know?
I think it's from the movie. I think it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where it's the one with him and Brad Pitt. And I think Leo's the stunt double for Brad Pitt, or Brad Pitt's the stunt double for Leo's character or something.
Yeah, it's like Brad Pitt's the stunt double. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
It's like a 50s era or 60s era, like, action kind of, it's like about making of these action. I've never seen it, but I know that meme from.
Oh, okay.
So it just so you know, it's about it's another take on like the Manson family murder. It's
yeah, that's right. That's what that movie. Yes, because yes, I'm like, it's like I know the name of that movie. What's it about? And then, yeah, now that you mention it, yeah, that's exactly what that is about. Yeah, I just didn't know that's where the meme came from. Okay, I have very strange digression, but Feanor makes the Silmarils, and capturing the light of the two trees imperishable in the form of gems. These aren't gems he's dug out of the earth. These are actually gems that he has fashioned artificially. Tolkien doesn't go into details, but like that, but that's, I guess, magically, but that's interesting. And it also mentions that perhaps he made the Silmarils because he had a bit of foresight that there was some shadow of foreknowledge that something was going to happen to the trees or something like that, or maybe he didn't even know that much, just that he knew he needed to do this for some reason. You know, kind of almost divine inspiration, maybe.
Yeah, but ultimately, he still does it for himself, because as we'll see later, he's like he just wants to hide these things and not and like show his sons that. And I think his dad maybe like, but no one else. He doesn't want to like show anybody. And it's just that covetousness. It's like the ring, you know, or you know, this is kind of like a prefigurement of the ring, where if you have the ring, you want to you know, keep it secret, keep it safe. You know, don't want to show anybody right. or let anyone know you. I mean, people know he has the Silmarils, but, you know, he's keeping them. I think you say they're locked away in iron, and, you know, deep in his chambers. So he must have, I'm just imagining like some big, huge vault, you know, castle kind of thing that he's locked away all these things in.
Which is like, he makes them, but he doesn't even enjoy them, really. He just locks them away. Like every once in a while, he brings them out for special occasions. But even then, it's just so that he can make people envious of the fact that he has them and won't share them.
Yeah. Well, I like how it talks about they start fashioning the gems and not just like stones they pull from the earth, but they really start fashioning them. And that gets me thinking, I'm like, well, what have they been doing the whole time? Like, have they just been digging rocks out and going, huh, this is a really cool rock. I'm going to set it here. And like not doing anything with it. They've not been cutting gemstones this whole time.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. Or maybe, you know, they have, but they haven't been happy with that. And they figure, well, if we can just create gems magically, maybe they'll be more perfect than, because I guess a gem, I don't really know much about this, but I would assume that like a gem is only as good as like the initial rough stone of what you can make out of it from the initial rough stone. Right. So maybe the elves are just always going for perfection. Like if we start from scratch, we can make like perfect gems, maybe.
Yeah.
Lab grown Silmarils.
That's right.
It's all the rage.
Right.
Well, they talk about that. Like the first ones he make are just like clear. But then if you put them in starlight, they reflect the starlight like the just like even the small stuff he makes is crazy awesome. And then he makes these Silmarils.
Yeah, and it says like the Silmarils shine of their own. Not only do they reflect outside light, but they shine with an inner light and like pulse, almost like a, like if they're like they're alive. Like they have some kind of inner essence. They almost like have a soul of some kind, because like, I guess because the two trees themselves are alive. And I guess it's not even so much that they just capture a bit of the tree's light. It's almost like they capture some of their life force. At least that's how I took it.
Yeah, it's unclear exactly how that works. And I mean, that's, you know, any actual explanation wouldn't, you know, fall short of what you can imagine. So
right, you just get midichlorians.
Yeah,
if you try to explain it. That's why I like that Tolkien keeps a lot of this stuff vague. Please don't explain the magic. It just leads to midichlorians.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because he puts that line in there. It's like nobody ever, ever, ever will figure out what these things were made of until Fëanor comes back.
Period. Yeah, the prophecy.
Yeah.
That was cool. Yeah, it says, not until the end when Fëanor shall return, who perished ere the sun was made and sits now in the halls of awaiting and comes no more among his kin. Not until the sun passes and the moon falls shall it be known of what substance they were made. And that's all we get of the Dagor Dagorath, the final battle in the published Silmarillion, by the way, is that vague prophecy. But the another interesting quote from the book is that apparently Varda hallows the Silmaril. So he does show them to the Valar at one point. And Varda hallows them so that thereafter no mortal flesh nor hands unclean nor anything of evil might touch them. And Mando speaks and says that the fates of Arda, earth, sea, and air are locked within the Silmarils.
Yeah, they didn't even ask him.
No, yeah, he just comes out with that.
And of course, like, he doesn't elaborate on it either.
Nope. They're just like, thanks, Mandos. Thanks for that.
He's like the wise man that goes and lives on the mountain, and you come and you get some vague, you know, vague saying every 20 years from him, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah. That was not as helpful as I wanted it to be.
But and since Melkor still has essentially, not lay of the land, that's like he's basically just allowed to walk around
free
at this
reign.
Point.
Yeah.
Free reign, thank you. Yeah, he sees them, and it says Melkor lusted after the Silmarils, and because of that, you know, he just hates Fëanor even more, and concocts this plan to break the friendship between the Valar and the Eldar. So, like, I think you said, Pat, it's all jealousy. That's what motivates Melkor. He doesn't create anything. He just wants to. He's that kid who he's like, if I can't have the other kid's toy, I'm just going to break it.
Yeah, pretty much.
And it's interesting because, like, later on, you'll see whenever Melkor or Morgoth at that point talks about the Silmarils, he always talks about them as if they were his. Right. And they're very clearly not, because they're literally burning him while he has them on his person.
Mm-hmm. So much so that he has to put them in the crown that he wears so that he's not technically touching them. You know, I thought it was interesting that not only do they cause evil pain, but also mortals who hold them will also they'll burn the flesh of more, which happens later. We'll see with Beren.
Poor Beren.
Yeah, poor Beren.
He loses that hand anyways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
May as well make use of the burning crystal while you're holding it.
I'm sorry, you were looking for untragic figures. You came to the wrong book. I love the foreshadowing here or the setup here, because you have, you know, you have Melkor, you know, he's about to go on this like secret campaign of convincing people or convincing the Noldor, basically, of a lot of different lies. And we get the same thing that this Sauron does to the Numenoreans, especially, and to the, some of the Eldar in the Second Age. Right. And then by the time you get to the Third Age, Saruman's taken up that mantle. So there's always this theme of like, there is this dark power that not only has sort of the mantle of like, I'm big and strong and I'm going to crush you, but also the, I'm going to sow discord within your ranks in order to divide and conquer.
Yeah. It reminds me of the gospel passage where Jesus says that Satan was a liar and a murderer from the beginning and is the father of lies. And that's pretty much Melkor here. It's like the serpent in the garden. He's in this sort of paradise on earth, going around spreading lies and spreading mischief. And it was interesting how they said some elves even they don't even remember where they hear these lies. They don't remember it's Melkor. They're, and some of them think it was their own ideas coming out of their heads. Which, by the way, that just reminded me of that scene from Rings of Power, where Celebrimbor's been after he talks to Sauron, he can't even remember that he's quoting Sauron directly. And because Galadriel's like, well, where'd you hear that? And he's like, oh, I made that up. And she's like, no, you didn't. Those are somebody else's words. So, yeah, you have this Sauron who can Sauron and Melkor can influence people to the point where they're so taken with these ideas that they're just like, oh, this was my great idea, you know?
Well, they say he can shapeshift like the other Valar. He can change forms. So he could be just going around and, he could be impersonating some of the other some of the elves. You know, your friend tells you something or whatever and doing it that way. But it could also be, you know, like when they're asleep. Well, I guess I don't think I'll sleep the same way like humans sleep. I think they kind of go into like this like lucid dreaming type of thing. I could be wrong.
Yeah, they meditate very deeply.
Yeah. And he could be just going over there and, you know, being a shadow that goes and starts whispering to them while they're doing that. And that influences them to stop, you know, to believe those lies.
Hey, are you awake? Are you awake? You know, it's like when your little brother comes over and like tries to like wake you up. You know, like,
yeah. Well, you know, as anybody who's worked for a manager knows, like inception is a real thing. And the easiest way to get your idea approved is to back up like 2 months before you need it approved and start mentioning it randomly in conversations around the water cooler and around the coffee pot. And hey, wouldn't this be a neat idea? Or what do you think about this? Or, and then by the time it gets to the point where you actually need the project, they think it's their idea.
Interesting.
You're influencing the algorithm and talking about the thing you want your significant other to buy you. You talk about it near their phone or their computer. He's just influencing the algorithm. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Siri, tell my wife this.
Oh, I heard that, Pat.
Oh, yep, you activated it.
I accidentally activated it. I told her I got the robot involved. I'm sorry.
Talk about the Eye of Mordor. You know, these things that are always listening to us. I'm like, geez. But yeah, you know, like there's an interesting quote where it says, he that sows lies in the end shall not lack a harvest. And that's true of Melkor here, because he definitely does not lack a harvest. And he doesn't just try for one type of lie. He comes from multiple angles. He starts telling him that, oh, you know, the Valar, they brought you here not because they wanted you to live in this peaceful realm forever and ever and ever and be happy. They're jealous of you. They don't want you to rule Middle Earth in their stead. So they're trying to keep you here. And then he modifies the lie a bit because he reveals to them the coming of men, which says Manwë had not yet revealed to the Eldar much about that. So he says, see, they took you away from Middle Earth. So because the Valar know that men are coming, and the Valar will be able to influence men more than they can influence you, because men are short-lived. And so they'll be able to rule Middle Earth through their proxies as men and steal it from you, who really deserve it. And I'm like, ugh, like, it's
Well, and it's funny because that's kind of the plan all along, but it's Melkor kind of twisting it, because the, you know, kind of the ultimate plan of Iluvatar is to kind of set men up to take over the, you know, stewardship of Arda while the elves, you know, return to Aman eventually at the end of Return of the King. So it's funny because it's, I mean, Melkor's telling him that, and that's kind of the plan, but not in the same way. Like,
There's a kernel of truth to it. Yeah. That men will supplant elves, but he's trying to, the way he presents it is that you are being robbed of what's yours.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I find that to be probably one of the most enduring lies that you still see play out in the Third Age. Like, you still see, even among some of the Sylvan elves, who view men as just this supplanting, terrible force that they wish they could get rid of if they could. But you definitely see that in the Second Age with the Noldor, in the First and Second Age when the Noldor come over and they start, you know, taking over. There are the three tribes of men, you know, the Edain, who they kind of adopt. But even they're sort of disdained by some of the more fickle children of Feanor, you know.
Yeah, there's like, you know, so yeah, like you say, some of the Noldor, you know, like Finrod, adopt men as vassals, but others, you know, not only like and I think you said like the Sindarl, I think that comes from Thingol, who initially wanted nothing to do with men. I mean, he gets a man as an in-law later, but he's still like, you know, he has that initial grudge. But I think that's why, you know, this is why Melkor's lie is so effective, is that it contains enough truth for it to be reasonable, you know? Because if he just completely made it up, they probably would have been able to see right through it. You know, it's like everybody has a BS detector, you know, and you can tell when something is just like, okay, that's obviously not right.
Too far.
If, you know, like, he goes on this, you know, fake news campaign, but he's able to sell it because, you know, and part of it, it says, is because of Manwë's silence, you know, is why it's so effective. You know, that if they had told them earlier about men, Melkor wouldn't have been able to spring this kind of surprise on them and then say, like, why have they been keeping this from you? You know, he's sowing that suspicion. And that's another, like, lie that endures into the later ages, is that the different people who fight the Dark Lord are also suspicious of each other, right? There's that line in the Fellowship of the Ring where I think it's one of the Elves of Lórien says that, like, one of the greatest strengths of Sauron is that he's able to sow mistrust among everybody who's against him. That divide and conquer, like you said, Pat.
Yeah, and it's like, I think this is by far the height of Melkor's cunning. Like, most of what he does within the Silmarillion is very, you know, smash and grab or
brute force.
Right? It's, you know, the war in the before the First Age time, the war that, you know, begins with the knocking down of the light, the lamps, and then the war that happens at Autumno, that's all very brute force, brute strength. You know, I am the ruler here. This is my domain, kind of a thing, versus the Valar. But this is full blown underhanded cunning. I'm playing chess, it turns out, and you're all still just playing checkers.
Yeah, he's very Loki at this point, you know, the shape shifting, the trickster aspect, the lies, you know. But Feanor is, he's taken in, but he's also not. The lies work on him, but he doesn't become friendly with Melkor. And he kind of sees that, you know, Melkor really wants the Silmarils. So he ends up, this is the point where he starts locking them up. And it says that he basically forgets that the light of the Silmarils is not from him, that he didn't make that. He made the jewels, but he didn't make the light that they contain. Almost like you said, Pat, how like later Melkor acts like they're like the Silmarils are his, like he made them. Feanor is acting that like, oh, the light of the Silmarils came from me. And it's like, no, they came from the trees. In his pride, he's forgetting that. So we have more family troubles in the House of Finwë. And this is, I'm pretty much sure also is like, this is all part of the plans within plans of Melkor's plot. But Feanor becomes estranged, particularly from his next, the brother, his oldest half brother, Fingolfin. So yeah, it says Melkor sows lies that Fingolfin and his sons are planning to usurp the leadership of the House of Finwë from Feanor. See, there's that part of that lie again. They're like, they're going to take what's yours. They're going to take what's yours. In this case, you know, Feanor is thinking that his younger brother is going to usurp him and take his rightful place. And he also like Melkor sows these lies, and not only is everything going to be taken from you, you're going to be banished, which of course ends up happening later, but for different reasons.
Yeah. Self-banishment.
Self-banishment, basically. Yeah. And Melkor, it says Melkor is the first one to teach the Noldor have been forging a lot of stuff, but not weapons, because they don't need them. They're in like an earthly paradise, but Melkor starts teaching them about the creation of weapons, which almost reminds me of the extra biblical Book of Enoch, where the watchers teach humans how to make weapons of war.
Yep. It harkens back to that line in Genesis where they talk about the sons of Ham building cities and setting up and working on all the different technologies, basically, and building crafting things. And Enoch just sort of takes that and expands it. And basically, all of these things they learn from the fallen watchers.
Yeah. Which reminds me, like, this is kind of like a maybe a Secrets of Movies and TV Shows thing, but they show up in that Noah movie.
Yeah, right? I was about the Watchers. To say, yeah.
Yeah. I've never seen that, but I probably should watch it.
Either.
It's Russell Crowe as Noah, right?
Oh, yeah.
I've only heard terrible things about it.
And I think Vin Diesel voices one of the Watchers, or like the rock monster that's like helping them fight the people coming to take the Ark.
Yeah.
I've not seen it, but that's what I've heard goofy things about it. So
my understanding is they're like the best part of the movie.
The Watchers? Yeah. Or see the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World episode on the what are they actually called?
Nephilim.
The Nephilim.
Nephilim.
Yeah, which is a great Nephilim. Episode, by the way. Oh, I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Yeah. Feanor is kind of the first to speak out the lies. And in other words, like he starts giving voice to them, you know, just saying out loud that we're thralls of the Valar. We're slaves. You know, we shouldn't be here. He starts spreading discontent, you know, his first sort of like, I guess his kind of entrance as like, you know, a quote unquote bad guy at this point, he's becoming a rebel. So Finwë's troubled by this, the chief of this particular house, Feanor, and Fingolfin and Finarfin's father, Finwë, he calls a council. And this is where a lot of the family drama comes to a head. Fingolfin gets there first and kind of calls out his brother. And then Feanor arrives and says, aha, I knew it. You're trying to take my place. And it's just this huge misunderstanding. Very effective scene, though. I feel like if this were in a show and done well, this would be a very dramatic scene.
Yeah. I mean, Feanor shows up fully armed in armor.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Like and I could imagine everybody going, okay, what just happened here? Like everybody else is probably dressed in clothes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say he's got a helmet with a giant plume on it, like a giant bird feather or whatnot. But he's got a shield and a sword, and he points, he unsheathes the sword and points it at his brother and tells him, no, your place. he tells him. But like every and but Fingolfin just complete. I like what Fingolfin does. He refuses to engage in this. He's just complete. He doesn't say anything. Like he knows he's being misunderstood because Feanor accuses him of trying to, you know, usurp his place in front of his father. But Fingolfin doesn't give in to the. To Feanor's goading of him, you know, to start something. But yeah, then Feanor, the Valar hear of this, obviously, and Feanor is summoned for a trial by the Valar. And finally, Mandos, speak up. Okay, yeah. The Doom, he's as the Doomsman, he basically gives Feanor his sentence. What is it again? Feanor is banished for 12 years from the city of Tirion, which is the Noldor's kind of major city in Valinor. And Feanor's seven sons and his father, Finwë, follow him into banishment. I don't know why Finwë does. He gives a reason, but I'm like, that doesn't wash. I'm like, why are you doing this? I think it's just because he obviously has a preference for Feanor over his other sons.
And Feanor has the Silmarils and he wants to go look at them.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I also think it kind of hints at it, but I think he also feels guilty. Like that this is where my son has ended up. And if he's going to go into exile, then I'm at fault because he's my son. So I'm going to go in exile and potentially this is an opportunity to work on my son.
Just you know what? Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Except you know, Feanor is Feanor, so good luck with that.
Exactly.
I love how they put it. Like he wouldn't take literally anybody's advice except for his wife's, and that was for only a short time.
That's right. Yeah. But Tulkas, as soon as he hears that Melkor is at the bottom of this. He runs right out of the council right away to seek for Melkor, but it's too late. And Melkor uses his shapeshifting power to become a cloud, a dark cloud, so he can just like fly away. And it says the light of the two trees dims, which is kind of a, you know, foreboding of evil. But then Melkor, you know, he escapes as a cloud. But then turns back into his humanoid form again because he goes to Feanor in his exile and tries to recruit him. And he's like, you know, the Silmarils won't be safe as long as you're in Valinor. And then Feanor calls him the Jail Crow of Mandos. Burn.
Yeah, that'd be pretty rough. Like, you think you're the ruler of the world and you get called, like... That guy that doesn't even talk, you're like lower than him.
You're the mouth of Mandos.
Yeah. Oh, like the mouth of Saria. But yeah, and so the chapter ends with Melkor departing in wrath as in the form of a thundercloud. And that leads us into our final chapter for this evening, The Darkening of Valinor, where... Melkor, where he's actually going, I think I forgot to write down the name of this place.
Oh, where Ungoliant lives?
Yeah, it's part of the mountains of Valinor, but it's got its own name. But it's in the south. The Valar think Melkor has gone north, because that's where his old stronghold is. But they search for him there and don't find him. Because he knew that they were going to search for him in the north. So he ends up going down south and he finds Ungoliant in this like cleft in the mountains. But I can't remember what it's called.
Avathar.
Okay. But yeah, it's the place where the shadows are thickest in the world. Because remember, at this time, there's no sun and moon. Only the two trees are providing light. And their light only reaches the outside world through that one past the Calicirion through the mountains of Valinor. So there's this one spot in those mountains where the gloom is darkest, and that's where you've got Ungoliant. And, you know, readers of The Lord of the Rings should know that Ungoliant is the mother of all of the giant spiders, including Shelob. So yeah, Ungoliant is the progenitrix of all the giant spiders. And what she is left deliberately vague. I think most people just assume she's another Maya.
Yeah, I think that's what she would have to be, because she's a not just an animal, like she's a conscious being. So I think, mm-hmm. yeah, I think like the ball, she's like a Balrog basically, except she, for one reason or another, turned into a spider and chose that form. Or maybe she was always a spider and, but was not like quite as evil and dark and hungry as she ends up being. But
yeah, I like how you have the, like the legends of the Eldar about what she is or where she came from, like that mm-hmm. she was born of the darkness outside of the world, or that she was born of the shadows itself. And you're kind of like, okay, well, objectively we're thinking no, but like, I always like how Tolkien does that. He gives four or five possible answers and said, well, this, you know, I'm not making this place up. I'm a historian and I'm just taking notes here.
I'm just the recorder. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Well, it kind of makes sense too, because of what Ungoliant does to the trees. Like she's like, along with Melkor, is like the worst thing that, you know, the second worst thing that ever happened to them, because she killed the trees. So she's kind of like this huge figure in their mythology. So even if the elves, like, who weren't there, they've heard of Ungoliant, and they, you know, they probably can't have, you know, ghost stories of her and what she did, you know, around their campfires and stuff.
Yeah. I like the idea of her as like essentially a Lovecraftian horror from the outer darkness, you know?
Yeah. I kind of like that too, to be honest. Like she's there. What is she? That, you know, we just don't bother her. Yeah, but what is she? Let's do something else.
It does mention that even if she did work for Melkor at one point, she basically disowned him and set up on her own, because she's not really interested in fighting wars and whatnot and trying to conquer the world. She just wants to consume all things to feed her emptiness. Again, very Lovecraftian here. She's this kind of like black hole of like, not just light, but, you know, she just consumes everything around her.
Yeah, I kind of, in my mind, she's sort of like the personification of hunger and consumption, which, you know, by themselves, like hunger as a natural process by which we realize we have to eat food to keep ourselves alive. Right. So it's not a bad thing. But it's one of those things that lies so close to temptation that it can easily become a means in and of itself. So, you know, like gluttony, effectively. So she is, maybe when she was first made, she was like the personification of like hunger in kind of a good way. And then now she's just effectively gluttony.
Yeah, gluttony to the point where like, when she consumes too much light, she vomits it back up as this stuff called the unlight. Where it's not darkness, it's, which is just the absence of light. It's a physical thing called the unlight that you can touch and feel.
Ugh. Well, that's how we get dark matter. That explains it.
She creates dark matter.
She created dark matter.
That's what her webs are. They're dark matter.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's interesting, you know, because eventually what we hear about her is like she kind of goes off to, you know, after what we'll talk about in a minute, but she goes off to essentially like the tales say that she's just somewhere consumed with hunger and like nothing will ever satisfy it.
She eats herself in the end, it says.
Yeah.
Ugh. It's gross. But yeah, Melkor is still able to intimidate her to, even if she doesn't feel she's working for him, at least intimidate her into cooperating. Because he puts on the shape of his Tyrant of Utumno form, his, you know, Dark Lord, probably in the armor and all that stuff. And he's able to basically browbeat her into cooperating. Because I don't think she wants to leave her little nest where she is. But he's like, but he promises her, you know, you'll have this unquenchable, you know, light that you'll be able to consume. So what does he say? Like, I'll give everything to you in both hands,
with both hands, right?
Which will That will come into play later.
Yeah, it will.
To his detriment.
Well, this is him, like, this is his final form, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he had mentioned, so once he takes this form, he never shifts to anything ever again.
Right.
He is always the Dark Lord of Autumno after this point.
Yeah, he never uses that shape-shifting power. And I don't know if it's because he can't or simply because he won't. Like,
yeah, I would tend to think it's that he won't, because it's like he's kind of finally accepted that he's the Stark Lord and won't change. So it's or you know, he's like convinced himself that he can't change anymore. So it's almost like it's, you know, a symbol that he is who he is that he's not going to change forms anymore.
It's a this is who I am. Take it or leave it.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I think it's tied in with the Silmarils. I think once he has those in hand, he can't. I don't think he can bring himself to become something that doesn't have hands. Effectively, like, he has to be able to have them, and so he is like trapped in this. Okay, I have to be a material being. Well, I'm not going to be any other material being, but then the best one, which is obviously the one I made. Kind of a deal. The best material being is this gigantic Dark Lord figure, so I'm just going to stay here.
So yeah, they end up sneaking back into Valinor properly. It's a they're very sneaky. They choose a time of feast, which is a kind of a holiday to praise Eru Iluvatar for the gathering of first fruits, and that conjures up the biblical image of the, you know, giving up first fruits, offering first fruits as a sacrifice to God in the Old Testament. But yeah, Manwë declares, and not only is this, it's not going to be just the normal feast of first fruits, but we're also going to use the feast to heal the rift that's arisen among the Noldor. So Feanor, even though he's technically been exiled, and I think his term of exile is still in place, he's ordered to come to the feast so he can reconcile with his brothers.
Only he goes. His kids and Finwë don't.
Right.
Which I thought was real. I guess it kind of makes sense, especially the more we learn about Feanor's children. But it didn't make sense to me why Finwë would stay back. I kind of felt like that didn't make any sense to me, because this is like, you know, the reconciliation of his son along with his sons. Right. This is the I am restoring my house to order. You know, I can retake my mantle, all of that stuff. But he's not there. And that always struck me as very odd. I'm not sure why Tolkien decided to do that.
Well, it could be just as a security thing of, you know, keep someone guarding the Silmarils. Because Feanor can't be there, Finwë is the next best thing, I guess. You know, that's could be one reason.
Yeah, and you're right, Pat. The reason he gives, which is like, oh, well, as long as Feanor remains banished, I'm unkinged, he says. And I'm like, what? Why?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't understand that. But you have the reconciliation scene. And it says, at least in word, Feanor deigns to be reconciled with Fingolfin. It's never clear whether he means it. But Fingolfin tells Feanor, half brother in blood, full brother in heart shall I be. Thou shalt lead and I will follow. May no new grief divide us.
Foreshadowing.
Yeah, I'm like, you're going to regret those. Yeah, Feanor's going to make you eat those words.
Poorly.
Yeah. You see Mandos off in the corner. You have chosen poorly. And at the very hour of them reconciling, Melkor and Ungoliant shows up. Melkor spears both of the trees with this giant black spear, and it says like the sap flows out like their lifeblood, and Ungoliant laps it up. Ugh, just gross.
It's a very gross scene.
Gruesome scene, yes. You're thinking about two trees dying, right? Trees, right? But no, very gruesome. Very gruesome scene.
Right, because you can imagine them just like withering and becoming all like, you know, and in the house I grew up in, we used to have a cherry tree in the front yard. And at one point it became ill, and it sort of I imagined it kind of looking the way this was, where it's like its sides had actually started to split open, and the goopy sap was like constantly oozing out of these gaping like wounds that were opening up on the side of the tree. So I always imagine that's kind of what we've got going on here. It wasn't pleasant looking. We eventually took that tree down, but because there was no saving it. But yeah. And as much as as Ungoliant is lapping up the light of the trees, she also sucks up all of those vats of shining light that Varda used to create the stars. So there's no satiating Ungoliant. I mean, she's hunger personified, and just belches out all of these dark fumes, which it described. The description is great. It says, like, more than the loss of light, a darkness that seemed not lack, but a thing with being of its own, for it was indeed made by malice out of light, and it had power to pierce the eye and to enter heart and mind and strangle the very will. Reminds me of the darkness of Mordor is described too.
Yeah, this gets used in there's another series of books by Terry Pratchett about it's an interesting series, but he uses the same concept. Like, you have darkness, but then you have this real darkness, which is, you know, as far from darkness as light is. And it's this whole other thing that's got its own being and its own kind of terror. And I love it as a concept, as a guy who took far too much mathematics, is you have like the zero line is not the end, right? You've got the negative numbers going on in the other direction. And so you have the positive on the one side light and the darkness on the other side. And it's interesting, like, Ungoliant is this like this changing thing that takes the light and turns it into unlight. So she's not just like, she's not just robbing something, like, she's robbing it and twisting it into the complete opposite of what it was. It's such a good, like, and you can tell, like, this is very much a Garden of Eden story. Like, the whole thing is very Garden of Eden. It comes down to the destruction of the trees and you know, Feanor is kind of playing the part of Adam, more or less. You know, it's very stretched, but it is a metaphor in that way. And like, the destruction of the trees, the destruction of like the paradise is so well portrayed in this scene, with the trees being not just like sucked dry by Ungoliant and destroyed, but they're what they were gifting the world, which was light, which is ultimately the source of all foodstuffs, you know, all green things, and anything that you know grows relies on chlorophyll, and turning it 180 degrees against it, and any creature that relies on sight, and will, right, going all the way back. I don't know. It's just so well done. It's probably one of my favorite scenes in at least the opening sections of the book.
Yeah, it's very mythological. Like, it reminds you of myths you've heard before, but it's so unique that it's just clearly it's its own thing. It really is, I think, one of Tolkien's greatest moments of like just creating this. It feels familiar, but also very fresh and original as a mythology, especially as a device, as we'll see later, for the creation of the sun and moon. Like, there's a lot of interesting ways in world mythologies how the sun and moon are created. I have not heard one that's exactly like this one.
I also like that from like the elves' perspective, especially the ones who were the Eldar, who bathed in the light of the trees. Like, there is a distinct things were better before it feeling that you get from them. Like, the sun and the moon are sort of these pale shadows of what the trees represented and gave the world. And it provides a very much like a, you know, men being the children of the sun and the moon, yeah, and the elves being the children of the stars, and then the Eldar in particular being of the trees. it sets them apart and kind of almost against each other, just from the get-go.
And if you think how, like, if sunlight is a pale comparison, what must of the light of the trees have been like? It almost makes you think of, like, almost a supernatural kind of heavenly light. You know, it's like Paul says, you know, no eye has seen, no ears, or like, you can't imagine what the light of heaven or the beatific vision is actually like. You know, as a mortal, you can't comprehend it. So like light, because like light is used for God as like a metaphor. But he's like, but since light is also a created thing, God's actually above light. So it's all, any metaphor you can use for God is by default an imperfect metaphor, because you have to use created things to create metaphors, and God is uncreated. So it even says even Manway couldn't peer with, and he's supposed to be the valor of sight. Even he can't pierce the darkness of the unlight.
Yeah, this just had me thinking, like, maybe instead of hunger, Ungoliant was the mire of darkness or something like that. Like, maybe that's why she's so drawn to the darkness. And when she was corrupted by Melkor, it led to her, you know, her being insatiably hungry for light, and her being able to, you know, consume the light of the trees, and then, you know, make the fumes of the unlight. So maybe that could be what kind of her original purpose was, as she was the mire of darkness.
Right. Darkness and shadows, not as bad things in and of themselves, but just another part of the created order. It says Tolkas beats the air in vain. Very funny line. Poor Tolkas.
Yes. Poor Tolkas. He's like, I've been doing it the whole time. This whole time I had him in my sights, and now I can't even see him this whole time. I told you, you know, you can kind of get that scene in your mind.
Yep. So this chapter ends on the downest of down notes. Melkor's vengeance is achieved. But it's not even the worst thing that's going to happen.
Nope.
In terms of like moral disorder. So yeah. Like, but in terms of like cosmologically, in terms of the mythology, it's probably one of the worst things to happen. Although you mentioned before that for Eru Iluvatar, the creation of the orcs is the worst deed of Melkor. But this ranks up there as like the top three worst things he's ever done. This is probably second after the creation of the orcs, or third if you count his initial rebellion.
Yeah. That sounds like a good episode. Like top 10 worst things Melkor did.
Yeah.
So then do we have to argue what was worse and what was better?
Yes. Yeah. We'll stake out a position and like argue why, you know?
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. But yeah, so what's your guys' kind of overview, you know, thoughts of these three chapters? A lot happens in them, and we've said they're kind of setup chapters, but also they're really compelling and gripping on their own, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is setting up the next section that we'll be getting into, where we start seeing more bad things happen. getting like you said, I think the description of Ungoliant killing the trees is one of the most vivid things. Like just we were talking about it, and I'm like having a visceral reaction to it of what that is. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely some of the best. I would agree. I think some of the best writing that Tolkien did was in especially this last chapter that we covered. But yeah, we finally are getting to see who Melkor is and who he will be for the rest of eternity, ? I guess.
Who knows? Bound and thrust into the outer darkness.
Yeah, it's like, does he get to keep his body? Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, no, I'm definitely in, like this section, and yeah, so looking forward to, well, I mean, it's interesting to read what happens. It's not very pleasant what happens for the next couple chapters, but
These are probably some of my favorite chapters from the whole book. Just because I always love the transition pieces in these kind of, and there's not many of these kind of books, but in these kind of books where you go sort of from the mythological down into the nitty gritty. And it reminds me a lot of the, Noah's story in the Bible in Genesis, because that the same thing is happening in that story. You are going from kind of these broad spanning statements about things about the world and how things function, where you get, you know, lines about people you've never heard of, and you don't get very much stuff. And you get down to Noah's sort of, he's interacting in this grand sort of mythological way with the flood, but he's also dealing with his family and the kind of the outfall from that and how that goes. And that's, these chapters for me are very much like that. You have these grand mythological things happening, but you also have like Fëanor and Finwë and the family drama and
yep.
And that, and I, so I don't know, it's just done so well. It yep. feels like Tolkien worked on this part a lot.
I think so. Yeah, because it's really the hinge of the, not just the Silmarillion, but the whole mythology, as Sam mentions in The Lord of the Rings. He's like, the light of the trees is still with us in the glass, the file glass that Galadriel gives to Frodo. Because it's the light of one of the Silmarils. It's that last pure bit of pure light from before the sun and moon. And so this impacts the whole red. That's why, like, Tolkien, he really saw, like, I've been reading I've mentioned this a few times before, reading through the expanded edition of the letters. And he really made the case to his publishers, Tolkien did, that the Silmarillion and the Lord of the Rings are one work. They're one big saga. Part one is the Silmarillion. Part two is the Lord of the Rings. And that it's one big saga of the jewels and the rings, but that they're all, you know, that you can't easily pull them apart.
You can tell it's done, how well it's done, because like you walk away from this chapter, this last chapter, and you hate Melkor. Like there's, you know, what he does next, you know, with the Silmarils and all that. Yeah, whatever. But like killing the trees, you're just like, oh,
yeah. And knowing later that some of the stuff that comes later is the fruit of his lies, too, that he's where we're going to see, I think next time, you know, the dreadful oath of Fëanor and how that is all of Melkor's lies kind of coming to fruition. And like they said, he won't lack a harvest, and he didn't. But yeah, that's it for this. Wow, that was a lot. So much goes on in these chapters. It's great. I think the next chapter up is pretty long, so we might end up doing that one on its own, just because there's so much that happens in it.
There's a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, before we go, we would like to thank our patrons, including Sean L., Susan R., Trevor W., Rosemary S., and Skipper J. Their generous donations help us to continue to create the Secrets of Middle-earth and all the shows here at StarQuest. And you can join them at sqpn.com/give. And we'd like to hear from all our listeners. Are you reading The Silmarillion along with us? What are your thoughts on these chapters? Did you also have a visceral reaction to the killing of the two trees? What are your thoughts on any of Tolkien's first age writings? You can reach out to us by email at middleearth@sqpn.com or by leaving a comment on our SQPN social media pages or by joining the discussion on our channel on the StarQuest Discord server, which you can find at sqpn.com/discord. Until next time, Jeff Hecker, thank you for sharing with me the secrets of Middle-earth.
Thank you, Thomas.
And Pat Mason, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. This was a lot of fun.
And once again, I'm Thomas Salerno. Thank you for listening to the Secrets of Middle-earth on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Secrets of Stargate. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/Stargate.